Good evening. I want to invite you, if you will, to open to Mark chapter 3. Mark chapter 3 is where we'll spend most of our time this evening. One of the interesting things about religious groups in our world at this point in time is the fascination there seems to be with numbers. You know, we live in the age of what has sometimes been referred to as the mega church. And some of these churches have more members than, you know, small towns have citizens. And the way that these churches many times are evaluated is simply, how many people can they bring together at one location. Now, recognize that disciples of Christ can't afford to be unconcerned about numbers, in as much as each number represents a person who is going to spend eternity in one of two places. But I do think we need to be careful to keep the emphasis in the right place. You know, all too often, churches bring in people by simply giving them what they want rather than making sure that they understand what they need and understand God's will for them. And the pursuit of more people and more people can become an end in itself. I think we see that in our society. And it seems to me that numbers take precedence over things like commitment to the will of God. In our lesson this evening, I want us to talk a little bit about a passage of Scripture in which we see some differences between merely being part of a large crowd that is kind of loosely associated with Jesus and being part of a select group of people who have been chosen by the Lord. And if there's one thing we can say about Jesus, it's that he wasn't mesmerized by the multitudes of people who followed him. And you know, we talk about that quite a bit. There were certain points in his public ministry when great crowds of people surrounded him, and this is going to be one of those occasions. Great crowds followed him wherever he went, and yet he wasn't really impressed by that fact. He understood that what people in our day sometimes seem to forget, and that is that you can't use the size of a crowd in order to judge whether or not something is legitimate, something is what it's supposed to be. And so he knew that crowds of people were capable, for example, of shouting as they did in Mark chapter 11 and verse 9, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." But he also knew that crowds were just as capable of shouting, as we see in Mark chapter 15 and verse 13, "Crucify him." And so Jesus didn't come merely to draw crowds. He came to make disciples, and there is a difference there. And so as we begin this evening, I want us to look at the crowd that followed Jesus in our text. And we're going to read beginning in Mark chapter 3 and verse 7, where it says that Jesus withdrew his disciples to the sea, and a great crowd followed from Galilee and Judea and Jerusalem and Idumea, and from beyond the Jordan, and from around Tyre and Sidon. And when the crowd heard all that he was doing, they came to him. And he told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. For he had healed many, so that all who had diseases pressed around him to touch him. And whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." And he strictly ordered them not to make him known. In this section of Mark's gospel, there are just a number of references to the fact that Jesus is popular with the people at this point in time. And when you look at what is said in this chapter, in the next couple of chapters or so, you'll find that there are a number of references to these large crowds that followed Jesus at this point in his ministry. So here we read in around verse 7 or so that there's a large crowd. You go down to verse 20, it says, "Then he went home and the crowd gathered again so that they could not even eat." You go to verse 32 of chapter 3, a crowd was sitting around him. In chapter 4 and verse 1, he began to teach beside the sea, and a very large crowd gathered about him. Down in verse 36 of chapter 4, leaving the crowd, it says, they took him with them in the boat. In chapter 5 and verse 21, when Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a great crowd gathered about him. And in chapter 5 and verse 24, a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. It's almost like Mark is trying to point out something here in this little section of his gospel. There are a lot of people following Jesus at this point. And if you were to take a map and look at all of the places that are mentioned there, it talks about people from Galilee and Judea, Jerusalem and Idumea, from beyond the Jordan, from around Tyre and Sidon. That's really almost from all around that region. People were coming from long distances to be around Jesus. And when you look at the way Mark described this situation, it's almost like a mob of people surrounding a celebrity. And I suppose that's exactly what Jesus was in the minds of many of the people who were following him at this point in time. You know, for a significant part of his life, there was a crowd around Jesus practically everywhere he went. And I don't mean a calm and composed crowd of people or a strained crowd who are just standing there or who are sitting there quietly in their places. This is like when the Beatles came to America kind of crowd. I mean, some of y'all are, I'm not old enough actually to know about that, but I've seen it on the reruns. Just people going crazy. People were pushing forward just to get to him. And Mark says in verse 9 that Jesus told his disciples to have a boat ready for him because of the crowd, lest they crush him. He could step onto the boat and they could kind of get away is the idea. If I understand it, that word crush is the same word that the Greeks would have used for the concept of pressing grapes in order to make wine. I mean, that kind of crushing. And the next verse talks about the fact that the people pressed around him in order to touch him. And so you get the picture here. Again, we're not talking about a calm and quiet group of people who are sitting patiently and are ready to listen to what Jesus is going to say to them. Now, I said all of that to say this. If we were to look at this situation from the standpoint that many people today adopt, we would have to say that Jesus is entering into what was, without question, his most successful aspect of his public ministry. You know, I mean, if you're that popular and you're drawing that many people, certainly, according to the way our world views things, that's a great success. But when you read what Mark says, you kind of get the impression that he's not impressed with these crowds. In fact, it is his intention to underscore the shallowness of the people who are coming to Jesus. You know, if there's one thing we need to understand, one thing that I think Jesus understood, it's that popularity brings with it some inherent dangers. And I think we're going to point out three of those. There are probably some others that we could talk about. But I want to point out three things that I believe Jesus understood. And that is, first, when you have people like that, there is the problem of misplaced emphasis. There is a potential for that, at least. You know, what was the chief mission of Jesus? Was it to heal people? Was it to cast out demons? Well, no, not really. His chief mission wasn't to heal people physically. It was to heal them spiritually. Basically, Jesus was a preacher, not a miracle worker. Back in chapter 1 of the Gospel of Mark, in verse 34, it says that he healed many who were sick with various diseases, and he cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. And rising very early in the morning while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place. And there he prayed. Jesus would try to get away from the crowds. And then in verse 36, Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him. And they said to him, "Everyone is looking for you." And notice the response of Jesus in verse 38. He said to them, "Let us go on to the next towns that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out. That's what I've come for." So why did Jesus perform the miracles? I think he did it at least in part because he felt compassion for people who were suffering, and I think that's important to recognize. He wasn't unconcerned about these people he came into contact with. But that wasn't the only reason. He also performed miracles, you know, in part to authenticate the message that he preached and to communicate to the people the fact that he had the power to deal with more significant problems than those that were physical in nature, the problem of sin. That's really what he came to deal with. Now, did most people who followed Jesus recognize that? Well, no, they didn't recognize that. They were emphasizing what was only a secondary part of the public ministry of Jesus, and his original and main intent was distorted. They just kind of ignored all of that. They didn't want to hear him preach. They wanted him to deal with their problems and fix the things that they saw that were wrong, not to listen to a message or his message. Now, when you get to be as popular as Jesus was at this time, there is an incredible temptation to do whatever you have to do in order to remain popular and to keep the crowd satisfied. And if Jesus wanted to keep the crowds no matter the cost, he would have had to have become nothing more than a miracle worker. It was his preaching that drove people away. It was what Jesus said that ultimately caused them to cry out to put him to death. You know, at the very height of his popularity, when Jesus finally just laid it on the line and told the people, "You are seeking me for the wrong reasons." He taught them what they needed to hear. In John chapter 6 and verse 66, we're told that after this, after Jesus did that, after he told them what they needed to hear, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. It started to go downhill from there, at least from the standpoint of the world. And so Jesus didn't give in to the temptation to do whatever was necessary in order to keep the crowds happy. But it does seem to me that many people in our day have done precisely that. Some people don't seem nearly as interested in the concept of being faithful to what God has revealed as in his word as they do the idea of packing again as many people into a building as they can. And I think that's, you know, that there's been a great move in churches in our day towards the thought of incorporating aspects of entertainment. And for that reason, that's what draws people many times. And what we need to be concerned about ultimately really is what Jesus was concerned about, what people need, not merely what they want. That's the difference. People may want to be entertained, but is that really one of the great needs of our day? No, we pretty much made entertainment. We built it into almost everything in our society. It's, you know, the thing by which everything is judged in our world, it seems. That's not the great need. Our job is to help people spiritually. And they'll have to decide for themselves if they want that kind of help. But even if they don't, that doesn't mean that we're at liberty to change our mission simply to appeal to them. You see, when you draw carnal people with carnal methods, the only way you're going to keep them is to just keep the carnality coming. That's just how that works. That's not God's will. But the second problem that comes along with popularity is the problem, what I'm going to call improper support. When you look at verses 11 and 12 of our text, it says that whenever the unclean spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, "You are the Son of God." And Jesus strictly ordered them not to make him known. You ever wondered why Jesus did that? I mean, why did he forbid the demons from telling who he was, these unclean spirits? Well, basically it's this. Jesus didn't need the endorsement of the devil. He didn't need that kind of support that he could offer. And they may have made an accurate confession. They were right. When they said, "You are the Son of God," they nailed it. There's no question about that. But nothing good would have ultimately have come from that if Jesus had allowed them to continue speaking that way, telling who he was. But I also can't help but wonder if there was another reason Jesus didn't want this to be said in this particular way. And that is that the people were not ready for the fact that he was the Son of God, that he was the Messiah. They had their ideas about what the Messiah was supposed to be, and those ideas were not in keeping with the kind of Messiah Jesus came in the world to be. And he didn't need the people trying to take him and to force him to be king. They did that on one occasion at the beginning of John chapter 6. They tried to take Jesus and make him king because he had fed the 5,000 with a little bit of bread and some fish. And the people decided, that's exactly what we want. This is the kind of person we want reigning over us. If Jesus is king, we will never have to work another day in our lives. He's just going to provide us with all of the things we need. And that's when Jesus, as I mentioned earlier, said, "Let me tell you some things that you need to hear." And it led to his disciples, many of them walking away. Jesus didn't need that kind of support. He wanted people who were truly ready to follow, not people who wanted to force him into the mold that they had made for him. You know, when you're popular, there are all kinds of people who want to jump on the bandwagon. They'll be ready to support you as long as you continue to be what they want you to be. And again, Jesus wasn't interested in that kind of support. And I think we ought to be careful that we learn the lesson from that we understand the principles, not to be influenced by what the crowd wants from us either, not to give in to that. A third problem that goes along with popularity is what I want to call shallow impact. Let me ask you, what do you think is the best way to leave a lasting mark in this world? If you really believed in something and you knew that you only had a short time to promote it, how would you go about doing that? Would the best way to be, I'm going to have a small amount of impact upon thousands of people, or would the best way to be to have a deep impact on just a few people who could then go out and reach others? I think most of us probably recognize that it would be better to get a few people who are deeply committed rather than thousands of people who are only superficial in their understanding. And that's the decision Jesus had to make. He could have focused on these large crowds that were coming to him, and he did teach them, don't get me wrong, but how much could he have accomplished with these thousands of people who are not really there to hear the things that he was saying? If Jesus was going to have an impact on the world, it would have to be it wouldn't be through small amounts of contact with great crowds of people. And I believe this is where the 12 come into this picture. And so I want to take the rest of our time this evening to look at the apostles, those who were chosen by Jesus, the 12. And the first thing that I want you to notice about them, or actually let's read what is said. Let's start in verse 13. He says, "He went out again beside the sea, and all the crowd was coming to him, and he was teaching them," it says. "And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax booth, and he said to him, 'Follow me.' And he rose and followed him. And as he reclined at table in his house, many tax collectors and sinners were reclining with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. And the scribes of the Pharisees, when they saw that he was eating with the sinners and tax collectors, said to his disciples, 'Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?' When Jesus heard it, he said to them, 'Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners.' And now John's disciples and the Pharisees," well, I'll be honest with you, I completely messed that up. I kept going, when is this going to get like what I want it to say? And I'm in the wrong chapter. Pardon me, let me go over to chapter 3. I kept reading in the wrong section there, and I was like, man, this is not reading like I want it to. I apologize. Chapter 3 and verse 13, which is probably where you were and wondering why I wasn't. "He went up on the mountain and called to him those whom he desired, and they came to him. And he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, and so that they might be with him, and he might send them out to preach and have authority to cast out demons. And he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder, Andrew and Philip and Bartholomew and Matthew and Thomas and James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus and Simon the Zealot and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. And then he went home, and the crowd gathered again so that they could not even eat," it says. Now, the first thing I want to say about these men from these verses is that Jesus appointed 12, it says, verse 14. And have you ever wondered about the significance of the fact that Jesus chose 12 men to be apostles? Why did he choose that number? Why did he choose a select group from within his followers to undergo, you know, more intensive training, you could say? As I've already suggested, the increased popularity of Jesus made it necessary for him to multiply his efforts. And the fact that he would only be in the world for a short period of time made it necessary for him to have at least a few people who were completely committed to him and to his cause. And I believe these things most likely had something to do with why Jesus chose the 12, why he called the apostles to this particular work. But again, why did Jesus choose 12 men? Why not 10? Why not 15? And I'm not sure that we can answer that question with any degree of accuracy because we're never told that. But there are a few things that I think we can suggest about why Jesus chose these 12 men who eventually came to be known as the apostles. If you were an Israelite, the number 12 would have been symbolic to you. It would have been hard to think of that number without thinking about the 12 tribes of Israel, the nation of Israel. And I can't help but think that that had something to do with why Jesus chose 12 men to be his apostles under the new covenant. The church, in essence, is the new Israel. Peter would later say in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9 that we are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession. That's what we are as Christians. And Jesus came into this world to establish his kingdom, and the 12 men that he chose to be his apostles played a significant role in that kingdom. I want to take just a minute to turn over to the Gospel of Luke and read something that's said there in Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22, and in verse 28, I want you to notice what is said. Jesus says to the apostles, "You are those who have stayed with me in my trials, and I assign to you, as my Father's assigned to me, a kingdom, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Now, I'm not going to tell you I understand everything that Jesus meant when he said those words to the apostles, but it at least says that these men were to have places of significance in the kingdom that Jesus came to establish. And it's interesting to me that when Judas died, you know, when he killed himself after he betrayed Jesus, the other apostles felt it was necessary to have a replacement. They wanted the number of apostles to be 12. Why? Perhaps that number 12 was intended to say to the Jews of that day, the church is the fulfillment of the promises and prophecies that were made to the children of Israel about the nation, about the kingdom. It is the kingdom that God promised that his Messiah would reign over. And that's exactly what it is. But I want to take a few minutes and talk about the mission of these 12 men. What did Jesus choose them for? I think you could sum up their mission in two broad categories. It was, number one, association, and number two, participation. The first is that the apostles were called to associate with Jesus. Look at verse 14. He appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him. And when you go from that point, they are, for the most part, consistently with Jesus in everything he does. And the reason for that is you can't be a reflection of someone you don't know. And so the first thing that Jesus called the apostles to do was to be with him and to learn from him. The essential ingredient in training is to get to know Jesus, not just some, you know, basic truths about God, but to truly come to know him. That's what the disciples were called to do. But they were not just called to associate with Jesus, but also to participate in his mission. And so it says there again, verse 14, he appointed 12, whom he also named apostles, so that they might be with him and he might send them out to preach. They're going to take the message. That word apostle comes from a Greek word that means to send forth. And an apostle is a messenger by nature. And Jesus chose these men so that they could take his message to a world that needed to hear it. But I want you to notice a couple of things about these 12 men. I don't want to look at their names or anything like that, you know, go through that whole list and do that sort of thing. But there are some interesting things we can say about these men. And two things I want to notice quickly. First, I think you can say that Jesus didn't choose these 12 men because of their abilities. You know, there's no indication anywhere in the Gospels that Jesus chose the apostles because of anything that they had accomplished. I believe they were chosen because they were teachable. Jesus knew what they could become. That's what he was doing. And second, I think we can say that these men Jesus chose were a diverse group. I mean, they were all Jews, I get that. But they were a diverse group of Jews. That ought to be obvious when you have someone like Matthew who was working for the Roman government as a tax collector. And Simon the Zealot, who wanted to run the Romans out of Palestine. I mean, these guys were from two different political parties. And what that says to me is that it doesn't matter what background people may come from, they can work side by side in service to the Lord if they are determined to be first and foremost followers of Jesus. But it has to be that first and foremost. If that's not a message we need to hear in our world today, then I'll just go ahead and tell you, I don't know what one is. I don't know what we need to hear then. So we bring things to a close this evening. I want to take just a moment to point out a few what I think are practical things that we can conclude from what we've talked about up to this point. You know, we still have crowds today. There are a lot of people in our world who make the claim to follow Jesus. But the truth is, I'm not sure that things are much different in our world today than they were when Jesus was upon the earth. There are still people who are nothing more than just part of the crowd. And you still have those who are among the chosen, not in the same sense as the apostles, but chosen all the same, those who are dedicated to him. And so I want to quickly point out three differences between the crowd and the chosen. And the first is this: the crowd usually prefers to be entertained, but the chosen prefer to be trained. You know, one group gets really frustrated when their church doesn't excite them, and they generally don't hesitate complaining about that sort of thing. The other group, the chosen, are more concerned when they're not being equipped to serve the Lord. Someone has pointed out that there are two basic approaches that we can take. We can either desire to grow, or we can desire to enjoy the show. You know, that's really about it. Which one of those are we interested in? Second, the crowd usually prefers to be anonymous, but the chosen prefer to be accountable. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. One thing about a large crowd is that it offers half-hearted people the appearance of commitment without the responsibility of commitment. Have you ever noticed that? You can hide among the group if that's what you want to do. Or you can use the group to help you get better. That's, of course, what the Lord wants. That's what we're supposed to do for one another. In Hebrews chapter 10, when it talks about the fact that we don't need to neglect meeting together, it gives the reason. It's not just, you know, we show up to show up and be here. That's not it. But it is to stir up one another to love and good works. That's why we come together, to hold one another accountable. And then third, the crowd usually prefers to be served, but the chosen prefer to be sent. And what I mean by that is some people only think in terms of what they get out of being part of a group. And all they want to know is how their needs are going to be met. And the chosen not only get something out of their relationship with the Lord and with his people, but they're also concerned about what they can do in his service. They have the attitude that is described in Isaiah 6 and verse 8, "Here I am, send me." They're willing to do that. And so the Lord wants people who are more than just a part of the crowd. He wants people who are truly willing to be his disciples. So that brings up the question for us this evening. Does that describe us? Am I truly a disciple of Jesus Christ? Do I really want to learn from him and be like him? Participate in the reason that he came into the world? Or do I just kind of want to hang out and be part of the crowd? Crowd that sort of, in a loose way, is associated with Jesus. Those are questions we need to answer. And the truth is there's only one right answer. You're here tonight, and you owe some duty to the Lord. If you've never obeyed the gospel, do that. If you know you need to, and you understand that, then don't put that off any longer. The Lord said, whoever believes and is baptized will be saved. Just take him at his word and do what he says. And if we can help you in some other way, to be right with him tonight, we ask you to come as we stand and as we sing.